Tonight, our speaker is Chris.
Hi, my name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
Thanks, Dave, for asking me to do this. I always get nervous doing this, but I really enjoy doing it. And the reason I enjoy doing it is because anytime I get an opportunity to tell the truth about myself and share my experience, I don't know necessarily if it helps anybody else, but I'm the one that enlarges my spiritual condition, and I'm the one that gets something out of it. So I always enjoy doing this. In the family afterwards, it says something to the effect that cling to the thought that in God's hands are dark past is our greatest possession, and that is, you know, the key to helping other people. And so that's, you know, my mission when I talk is to share a little bit of me and exactly where I came from and what happened and how I got sober and what it's like today. And when I can stay on course like that, I'm the one that benefits from it. Welcome to the new guys. A little bit of what it used to be like. I started drinking when I was very young. The first time I drank half a fifth of Jack Daniels, and I blacked out, and came to the next day and swore that I would never do that again. And I didn't for a week or two, and then I did it again. I had the disease of alcoholism prior to ever picking up that first drink. The doctor's opinion talks about being maladjusted to life and that we're in full flight from reality, and outright mental defectives, some of us to a certain extent and others to a great extent. And I was one that had that to a great extent. Also, it talks about that there were some of us that were normal in all respects except for our reaction to alcohol, that we were seemingly able, intelligent, friendly people. That wasn't me. I wasn't seemingly able, intelligent, or friendly. I had the disease of alcoholism, and alcohol gave me relief from the stuff that was going on inside my head. A lot of times I hear people talk about how, you know, they never fit in and they felt alienated and apart from and separate then and inferior to and so forth. I felt all those things, but early on, alcohol was just relief from the nuttiness in my head. It didn't make me feel a part of. It didn't make me feel as equal to or as good as. It did later in my drinking. But early in my drinking, it was almost as if it was in essence preserving my sanity. I mean, it just gave me enough relief from the underlying causes, conditions in my life to just take a little bit of the steam out to where I could continue to live. And I believe that, my guess is if I didn't have the alcohol, that I would have just gone over the edge. I mean, I just, you know, it would have been like a pressure cooker. I mean, it just would have kept building and building and building until I snapped. And alcohol gave me relief from that and prevented me from snapping. The majority of my early drinking was two different types of drinking. One was to capture the buzz, and the other was to drink to oblivion. And in a lot of cases, I drank. My goal was to drink to oblivion. But after just a few years of drinking, I started to notice the loss of control. There were nights where I had intended on going to a kegger in high school and just drinking 7 or 8 or 9 beers, and then I'd come to the next day and had blacked out the entire night before. I had no intention of getting hammered. All I had was the intention of catching that buzz and maintaining that buzz and then coming home and, you know, getting to bed and getting up the next morning and getting on with my life. So I early on recognized that I had the loss of control. And deep down inside me, I knew that there was something wrong with that picture. I mean, the first time that happened or the first time I recognized that happened, there was something inside me that was like, this isn't quite right. But it was easily pushed aside to continue on. I started getting into trouble periodically with my drinking. I started getting minor impossessions. I got DUIs early on, and I was a runaway. I ran away from home. I'd get I'd drink to excess and run away from home, and I'd make it out to Idaho or to Eugene or somewhere, and then I'd sober up and feel guilty and call my parents, come home, So little by little, the drinking, I was starting to have a little bit of trouble right off the bat with my drinking. And my drinking career is only 11 years long, but for whatever reason, it just progressed very rapidly. I mean, I don't think I ever even started in the early stages of alcoholism. I mean, I started right in maybe in the middle stages, or, you know, I'm as a blackout drinker from the very beginning. And I also was a daily drinker from the very beginning. I used to, when I tell my story, I would say I became a daily drinker later on. That's not true. I became a daily oblivion drinker later in my drinking, but I was a daily drinker from the very beginning. I drank as early as in 7th and 8th grade. I was drinking before I'd go to school. I was drinking at lunch. We'd cross a field over to a buddy of mine's house, drink three or four beers, and three or four beers to a 7th grader was just the perfect level, you know, to come back and face school. And I ended up, I went to Jesuit high school and was kicked out of Jesuit high school my senior year, 6 weeks before I graduated, and for drinking-related stuff that I had done. And that was my first experience of law. I had already had some encounters with them as a result of my drinking. And most kids that have the rebellion in them, you rebel against their parents by, you know, maybe spiking their hair or painting their hair a color, or, you know, tattoos and earrings and nose rings and other piercings and so forth. I rebelled against my father by becoming a logger. He had come from a lumber family outside of Eugene, and his whole mission in life was to get out of the logging business. You know, he had relatives that had been killed doing it, and go to college, move to, you know, a metropolitan area and become a businessman and never have to work in the woods. And so the minute I was kicked out of high school, I went to work in the woods as a logger. And those guys were truly professional drinkers. Everybody was at least 10 years my senior, but I fit in perfectly with the way they were drinking. I'd drink a lot of those guys under the table. In fact, I would even do things like the thing that takes you out into the woods is called a crummy. And the crummy ride home from work, you know, we would just drink, and then we'd hit a bar and drink, and then we'd get up at 2:30 in the morning, catch the crummy, and I'd swear I'd never do it again, you know, and that's it, I'm done, so forth, until after work we'd get in the crummy and I'd drink on the way back. Because I was the young one, and there was the sharing of alcohol, I would do things such as buy bottles of MD 2020, because I was sure that these guys wouldn't drink MD 2020 or Mad Dog, you know, that they would just let me have my stash, and which is true for most of them, except for the other professional drinkers. They didn't care that it was Mad Dog, and they just split the Mad Dog with me. But I was doing things to that logging crew. I was embarrassing them. We'd go out drinking, and I'd get them 86'd out of bars for, you know, getting in fights with women and, you know, getting the entire crew 86'd out of bars and so forth. And right off the bat, but around this time, I was doing a lot of attempts to control my drinking and to quit drinking. And I would do things like I would even write out plans on how I would drink and how, you know, the different types of methods that I would do to drink. I would only drink in certain occasions, this and so forth. And which I would, you know, come to the next day every time and go, you know, how did it happen again? How did this happen? You know, day after day after day. And so that kind of characterizes the majority of my early drinking was just a lot of relief drinking. I had a lot of depression, and I had a lot of free floating anxiety and fears, and just a lot of tension. And that alcohol just gave me enough relief from that stuff to where I could continue on. In the fall of 1985, I made a decision to no longer try to control my drinking. I had went to college. I'd been out of high school for some time and had gone to college. And when I got down to college, I had this conversation with myself where I was like, you know, I've been fighting alcohol for, you know, a long time now, and I'm done with it. I'm a drinker, and I'm going to drink. And I made that decision, and for the next 3 weeks, I drank to oblivion. I blacked out every day for 3 weeks. And at the end of that 3 weeks, I remember thinking to myself, God, am I going to be able to stop this? And, you know, it was, I've heard said that alcoholism is the only progressive fatal disease that has a fun phase. And that was my fun phase. That was the answer to my alcoholism, or the ism, was the daily oblivion drinking. I was happier drinking that way than I was drinking the other way, where I had temporary periods of dryness or sobriety, and not sobriety by our definition, but dryness. And that type of drinking on a daily basis, it worked for me. And it worked for the next couple months, where I really was in, I drank every day. I did nothing. I mean, I was supposed to be going to college. I didn't go to college. I just drank. And after a couple months of that, you know, that fun phase started to again be checkered with problems, and the problems started mounting again. You know, another DUI, more trouble with the alcohol type arrests, and then once again I started the attempts to control and enjoy my drinking, or to quit altogether on my own. But at this point, somewhere in there, I had crossed over another line. I crossed over a line where, at one time, I might be able to back it off a little bit for at least a few days. Now I couldn't even back it off for a day. I would get up in the morning, you know, from the night before, you know, after experiencing some sort of humiliating, degrading, shameful type of thing that I would do when drinking. I'd get up the next morning sick and shaky and sweaty, and you know, and swear that, you know, that's it. You know, I'm done. And sincerely mean that I was done. You know, this is it. I'm absolutely through with drinking. And only to, just hours later, after, as soon as I just start feeling a little bit better, I'd be drinking again. Sometimes it was just a matter of like, screw it, I'm drinking. Or it was, sometimes it was, you know, preceded by this thinking that would happen. You know, well, maybe if I only drink, you know, this way, or if I only drink this type of alcohol, or if I only do this. And it was almost as if a light bulb would go off in my head, and it would be like, yeah, well, that's the solution. If I drink a glass of water in between each vodka Collins, then I won't drink as much and I'll be okay. And, you know, the only thing that that ever did was expedited me wetting the bed earlier in the night than, you know, later. So in June of 1986, I went out on a normal drinking night and came to the next morning once again, you know, full of shame and guilt and remorse, which shame, guilt, and remorse is something I lived with my entire drinking career, regardless of whether I had done anything the night before. Something about maybe just committing suicide slowly through the drinking maybe was, I don't know why. I just had it, though. I had guilt, shame, and remorse every morning I woke up. And I woke up, or came to, in June of 1986, once again, having done some, you know, horrible thing the night before, you know, piecing the night together, and, oh, God, I did that again. And so I decided, I was living in Ashland, Oregon at the time, and I'm originally from Portland, and I decided what I need to do is I need to wean myself off of alcohol. And I was scared to death that I would get the DTs because the quantity I was drinking, and there had been one day in the previous 12 months where I hadn't drinking to excess. And so I got out on the freeway and hitchhiked up to Portland, and my plan was to go from 5 beers to 3 beers to 2 beers or something like that, and then completely get off. Well, the third day of detoxing, I just went out of control. My head was out of control. I was, you know, I would get these, this was fairly common when I was going through withdrawals, but I would get this weird organ music in my head, and then I'd get a little voice behind me that go, Chris. And I'd turn around, you know, and nobody would be there. In fact, I thought for a long time that everybody that had a hangover got voices and organ music. I thought it was actually a part of just having a hangover. I didn't realize that that was part of alcohol withdrawal. But, I ended up going off the deep end through withdrawal, and I checked myself into a detox. And down here on Northwest Lovejoy, 19th and Lovejoy, and it was a medical detox. They, you know, detoxed me for 5 days on Librium, and they were checking my heart, my blood pressure around the clock. And then when I got out of the detox, it was attached to an inpatient treatment center, which I had no intention of going to a treatment center. It's just that My insurance wouldn't cover the detox unless I stayed for the inpatient. And so I ended up staying for 28 days inpatient. And I went through all the motions of that. And it was my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous as they took us into meetings. And I can remember sitting in these meetings, and they were podium participation meetings like this. And I remember guys, you know, sauntering, so it seemed, up to the podium to kind of lay on the wisdom and pontificate. And they'd slam the book up here and I'd sit out there, and they, you know, they'd say, "If you want what we have," and they'd flash the book around and so forth. And I, you know, the thing I can remember specifically thinking that I have to drink. I like the person I am when I'm drinking. I'm the person that I've always wanted to be with a certain amount of alcohol in my system. You know, 10 drinks made me feel like what I thought everybody else felt like normally. I didn't like who I was when I wasn't drinking, and these guys were preaching abstinence, and I didn't hear anything. They may have been saying a lot of other things. I mean, I had selective hearing, I'm sure, too. But I just, you know, I was at that place where I couldn't imagine life with alcohol, and I couldn't imagine life without alcohol. And anyway, soon after that, I was drinking again, and I drank for about 7 more months after that. And now I was going through all sorts of stuff. I mean, my tolerance level had fallen. I used to have this tolerance where I could drink 15, 18, 20 drinks and still be coherent. I slurred a little bit, but I was still functioning. And now there was times where I'd have, on my 5th drink, I'd go into a blackout. And I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know. I used to be able to gauge it. I could get to 14, 15 drinks, and then I got into trouble, you know, but at least I had the enjoyment of the first 14 or 15 drinks. Now it was just a roll of the dice every time I picked up a drink. And in that last 7 months, I tried everything that I could to quit drinking and to control drinking. And I tried all sorts of different methodologies, self-help books. I tried reading the big book. I tried, you know, on my own at home, you know. I tried all sorts of methods, and all of them had failed. In January of 1987... I did 8 days in Jackson County Jail for my 3rd DUI, and I got out of the Jackson County Jail. I was out in the streets of Ashland, and I got arrested one more time. When I was arrested, the police department, who knew me on a first-name basis, and took me aside and said, "You know, Chris, you've got a hell of a drinking problem. You've got to do something about this. I mean, this is ridiculous. You know, you've got to do something." And they said, "Go see this guy, Joe. Joe's an expert on alcoholism." And I thought, well, okay, thanks, you know, and I went on. And before I go there, I also want to say this. One of my geographics about 3 months before that, in this period where I was really trying, was up to Alaska. I got a job on Hecata Island, which is several hundred miles outside of Ketchikan. It's a dry logging camp. So it's a float plane ride away from any liquor. I mean, you have to take a plane to get there. And after 3 weeks of being in this logging camp, some guy showed up and had smuggled a bottle of whiskey into the logging camp. And they said, "You want a drink?" And of course, mine was like, "Well, it's been 3 weeks, so I'm probably not an alcoholic." And, you know, grabbed the bottle. I started taking some gulps out of it, and they grabbed it from me and said, "Hey, we got to make that last." And I had thought that they meant we were going to drink the bottle. So I'm a float plane ride away from Ketchikan, Alaska, and the phenomenon of craving kicks in. And I came out of my skin out there. Next morning, I caught a float plane into Ketchikan, went straight to the Folksville Bar, which is this famous bar in Ketchikan where, like, the loggers and the fishermen gather to drink and fight. And I went in there. And I went with this guy who came from the logging camp with me. He had like 3 drinks in me and turned to me and said, "So you think you're pretty badass, don't you?" And I mean, he was ready to fight after 3 drinks. But anyway, I ended up in jail. That night. And to make a long story short, they threw me in a holding cell with a couple other guys. And I was on the bottom bunk in this holding cell. And when I came to in the morning, the guy on the top bunk was leaning over, looking at me, and I opened my eyes, and he's like, hi, I'm so-and-so from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've got 30 days sober, and I'm in here making my amends. And all I can remember is like, oh, my God, I can't get away from these people. Yeah. In Ketchikan, Alaska, this guy's trying to 12-step me, my cellmate. But anyway, so I was being arrested by the Ashland Police Department, and they said, go see this guy, Joe. The following day, I was walking down the street, and there was one of these, you know, these preachers, these corner preachers that stand and babble scripture in Ashland. And his name was Monty. I knew him because I'd seen him in jail a few times. And so as I was coming by him, I said, hey, Monty. And he goes, hey. And then he babbled some scripture at me. And I walked about 10 more feet, and I said, you know, if I was one of those AA people and I actually believed in God and I believed that there are no coincidences like they talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous, what he said almost duplicates what the police department said last night, go see this guy, Joe. And then I thought, well, what if for once in my life I just give it a shot? What if I say, yeah, there are no coincidences that this, you know, scripture reading, babbling guy on the corner, actually, there is a message between the police department and these two guys. And I thought, yeah, I have nothing to lose. I'll give it a shot. So I went up to go see this guy, Joe. Initially, he didn't want to see me because he knew who I was. And his secretary said, well, you know, what do you want to see him for? And I said, well, I want to see him about a drinking problem. And as she went in to go tell him, I was like, please not Alcoholics Anonymous. Please be something different. Please be aversion therapy, you know, 10 days, couple two-day follow-ups, and, you know, his life's perfect now, you know. Anyway, I went in, and sure enough, of course, it was Alcoholics Anonymous, and he tells me his story and so forth, and at the end of his story, he says, would you like to go to a meeting tonight? And for some reason, I felt this an obligation, since I did ask him for help, to go to that meeting, and I went to that meeting, and those people, you know, every single person that shared told a little bit of what it used to be like, what happened, what's like now. When I'd been to meetings before, there was just more pontificating on, you know, every answer in the world is in this book and so forth. Not that I disagree with that, I just didn't understand it as a new person. I understood when people talked about the way they drank and the way they felt, and now they were sober. And I walked out of there with some hope. I had so much hope that I didn't drink the entire next day. And that was something that I hadn't done in a long time, gone a full day without drinking, other than being incarcerated. I drank after that because I didn't come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And on February 4th of 1987, I went out one more time to prove that I could control my drinking. And I went out and was going to only have 10 drinks. And the guy I was drinking with was late. I drank 9 drinks before he even showed up to my house to go down to the bars to start drinking. And we went out, and I did my normal routine. I was in and out of a blackout. I had one hand over my eye because I was seeing double, and I ended up attacking a bartender at a bar where I had just secured a job as a bartender. Like an hour or two earlier, I was a shoe-in for this job, and he had cut me off, so I attacked him. He called the police, and one more time I was arrested, I had been through many other events that were significantly more horrendous than this one arrest. But for whatever reason, something inside of me happened that night. And as they were arresting me, I mean, I knew I could not do this anymore. And that police officer was standing with his revolver next to me, and they hadn't cuffed me yet. And I thought, you know what? Grab that revolver and shoot him and flee. And then I thought, my next thought was, no, you know, I get arrested for everything. I mean, I get caught, and grab his revolver and shoot myself. And before I could act on that, not that I know that I would, I mean, it may have just been a drunken thought, and maybe, but there was something going on inside me. And they took me in, and they cuffed me and took me in, and they ended up later that night, they took me home and dropped me off, and I went in. I remember before I passed out that night, I remember thinking, I wonder if I'm going to feel this way in the morning, you know, because that night I was done. I mean, something had changed inside me. And when I got up in the morning, I still did feel the same way. I was absolutely through. I'd hit a bottom. I could not imagine living another day the way I'd been living. And death was a more attractive alternative than to keep on doing the life the way I'd been doing it. And I considered suicide, but being Catholic, there was some hesitancy there, and as well as I had a little brother that just idolized me, and I couldn't imagine him knowing that, you know, his older brother did himself in. And so I prayed to a God that I wasn't even necessarily sure I believed in, and I said, please God, make this stop or kill me. And I also had the conscious thought at that time that, that, you know, if I have to believe in God, then I will. Because I knew in Alcoholics Anonymous there was a lot of emphasis on spiritual action and a higher power. And so in hindsight, looking back on that, what I believe is I always fundamentally had an idea of God or believed in God. It's just that I had denied God, you know. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started doing the things that they told me to do in the 90 meetings in 90 days and getting a sponsor and working the steps and so forth. And the obsession to drink was lifted. I was somebody that lived in the obsession on a daily basis to drink and absolutely could not drink. And coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and taking some of the simple actions that they had suggested, that obsession was lifted. And so little by little, I got sober and my life began to improve. However, alcoholism, the underlying causes and conditions, the things that were still there, the feelings of inadequacy and inferiority and the different than and this free-floating anxiety and this sense of impending doom and this depression all still were very much alive in my life. I was better, but I still had all that stuff. I got to 9 months sober, and I called a guy in the program, and I said, God, I'm coming out of my skin. I mean, I've got so much anxiety. I can barely function, and I've got so much fear, and I'm so depressed, and I've got this sense of impending doom. And he said something to me that probably is not an advisable thing to say to somebody with 9 months, but it was the exact right thing to say to me. And he said, you know, what you have is beyond what Alcoholics Anonymous can take care of. You should go see a psychiatrist and get on some medication for this stuff. And I hung up the phone after that, and I was like, oh my God, you know, I've been anesthetizing myself all my life. And you know, here once again, I'm supposed to go get on something to take care of this stuff. And when I say this, I'm not anti-drug or anti-medication. I'm just simply sharing my experience. In fact, I get guys that call me once in a while and say, hey, do you think I should get on antidepressants? And I say, what I think is you're an idiot for asking a stockbroker medical advice. But what happened is I hit a bottom, and I made a decision that day. I hadn't done the steps yet. And I made a decision that I was going to go through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and work the steps exactly as they're outlined in the Big Book. And if when I got to step 12, if I didn't get any relief from this, then I would do myself in. And so I started in on that fourth step, and I was extremely thorough in my fourth step, and I got my sponsor, and we got to reading it, halfway through my fifth step, I went into the restroom, and one of the habits that I added that I had had all my drinking life was I would go to the mirror every time I was in the restroom, and I would either tear myself down or I'd build myself up, and it all originated somewhere from inside my gut or inside my soul, and it was just like, this is what's wrong with me, this is what's wrong with me, this is what's wrong with me, this is what's wrong with me. Or I'd get in there and I would be full of bravado and pompousness. This is what's right with me. This is what's right with me. This is what's right with me. You know, aren't I great? And then 30 seconds after I pumped myself back up, I'd sink right back down because down in the pit of my stomach, I knew I wasn't so hot. And halfway through reading that fist up, I turned to the mirror and I looked in the mirror to do my normal routine that I'd been doing for years, and nothing happened. And I sat there and I looked at myself in the eyes and I was like, what is this reaction I'm getting? You know, what's happening? And I kept trying to identify what is it that I was feeling from this. And finally I realized what it was comfort. And it was the first time that I'd ever experienced comfort in my own skin prior to or without any sort of alcohol in my system. You know, that I experienced what I was looking for from those 8 to 10 drinks. Those 8 to 10 drinks was, got me to a place where I was just like, and comfortable. And I experienced that looking in the mirror that day. And I went out and I finished my fifth step, and I got and did my sixth, and I did my seventh. And there were some lifelong underlying causes and conditions and character defects that I had had that I wouldn't say were completely removed, but a lot of them were removed significantly to where there was just a fraction of them left. And I didn't even necessarily believe that this stuff would do that. You know, and in the big book, between steps 5 and 6, it talks about fears will fall from us, that we'll feel like we're walking hand in hand with our Creator. And that stuff started happening. And I didn't even know it said that. But the fears left, a lot of the fears left. The anxiety dissipated to a place where I could function in society comfortably. Yeah, I still would get anxiety. I'd still get fear, but so much of the power was taken out of that from it. And that's really from the 5th and 6th and 7th step. And that's really where I really became a believer in this program. Up to that time, I was like, yeah, I believe that it takes away the obsession to drink. But this is where it took care of stuff that was underlying, you know, my in a part of my life for a long time. And lastly, what I'm going to close with and what our topic is going to be tonight, my life improved significantly. I mean, I got to a place where I became reliant on God. I started practicing these principles. I became a believer in this program. And everything about me today is as a result of this program. I was somebody that, you know, I couldn't look people in the eye. I couldn't even walk past them on the street. I was somebody that if I was walking down the sidewalk and there was somebody else coming from the other direction, I would cross the street so I would avoid having to have eye contact with them or talk with them. And you know, through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and practicing this stuff and being of service, you know, my life has just continued to evolve, and I've continued to grow as I continue to work on the maintenance of my spiritual condition, and I, you know, practice being honest, and I practice these steps, and I, you know, do the suggestions, the basic suggestions of this program. My life continues to get better. And I mean, and not that it's not that life doesn't happen. I mean, life happens, but my reaction to life is significantly different than the way it was when I got here. The way I perceive you, the way I perceive events, the way I perceive just the world around me is completely different. So for a topic tonight, I want to talk about right between steps 10 and 11, it says, it is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all our activities. How can I serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. And so as a topic, I want to talk about the maintenance of that spiritual condition. And, you know, what I do today as a part of that maintenance is, I do prayer and meditation. And I really try to bring God with me throughout my entire day and try to practice relying on God. And I fall short. I mean, every day I fall short, but I'm continuously trying on a daily basis to turn it over to God and rely on God. I start my day off with prayer, and then I also do meditation. And I spend a good chunk of time in the morning doing meditation. And then I go to 4 to 5 meetings a week. I talk to other alcoholics. I sponsor quite a few people. And, you know, I'd get out and try to carry the message and share my experience with the idea that it may help somebody else. And maybe they identify with something I have to say and then come to believe that maybe this thing may work for them too. And being of service. And, you know, it says that as ex-problem drinkers, our very lives depends upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. And I do that from everything from, you know, being of service in Alcoholics Anonymous to being service out there and really trying to practice this stuff out there, you know, because Alcoholics Anonymous meetings is probably the easiest place that I can practice this stuff. And what really counts is when I leave these rooms, what am I doing to enlarge my spiritual life outside of this room? And what am I doing, you know, to try to rely on God and be of service outside of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and really practice this in everything I do. So as a topic, it is the maintenance of that spiritual condition. Thanks.